The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to John. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. But early in the morning, he arrived again in the temple area, and all the people started coming to him, and he sat down and taught them. Then the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery and made her stand in the middle. They said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say?" They said this to test him, so that they could have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and began to write on the ground with his finger. But when they continued to ask him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let the one among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again he bent down and wrote on the ground. And in response, they went away one by one, beginning with the elders. So he was left alone with the woman before him. When Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She replied, "No one, sir." Then Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, do not sin anymore." The Gospel of the Lord. In my last week's bulletin article, we were talking about adult formation and about how my generation, anyway, the catechesis of the church had generally failed. These were the years right after Vatican II, and there was a lack of resources. Quite frankly, there was a lack of resources, and the religion books that we had in the schools, my parents didn't like. So what they did was they pulled out their Baltimore catechisms from when they were children. And we would go to Catholic school, but we would also memorize the Baltimore Catechism every Sunday after we got home from Mass. It was indeed a difficult time. I remember we were at one school in a suburb of Kansas City, Missouri, and we got in the car one day after school, and my mom would always say, "What did you learn in religion today?" And we would say, "God is love." And my mom would say, "Love, love, love. Is that all they teach you anymore?" And I remember thinking, well, that's not such a bad thing. But we could have had a little more substance, I guess. But there was this one day when we got in the car and my mom said, "What did you learn today in religion class?" And my mom, and we would say, "Well, today was really interesting. Sister had us all sit in a circle on the floor and she played soft music and she taught us all how to do transcendental meditation." And we were yanked out of that school in the middle of my fifth grade year, and we found ourselves in another school the very next day. It was a difficult time. But the whole reality of Vatican II was also very difficult, because the media was covering the meetings of Vatican II, but the texts of the council themselves didn't follow in translation until years later. So opinions had already formed, especially in the area of liturgical reform. The politics of the time and the lack of source documents in the 1960s was just as real as the lack of real documents in translation in the 1500s at the time of the Protestant Reformation. Without the source texts, it's very difficult to know what the church teaches. And we don't know what we don't know. So 60 years later now, I would ask, how many of you have actually read any of the documents of Vatican II? You don't have to raise your hand, but usually it's the people who teach, if they teach in the parish, that's who it is. It's because nobody read them. And they are available. They're readable. If you look at the book, it's pretty big, but it's a lot of different documents, you know, so take one out on the Word of God, or take one out on the liturgical life of the church, or the place of the church in the modern world. But 60 years later, the church still hasn't read any of these documents, even though they were probably the most profound reform in the history of 2,000 years church. Now, I say reform, not change, but because no one knew the history of the church or the text documents of Vatican II, it just seemed like change. Now we see division in the church over Pope Francis, who is simply trying to reintroduce the world to what happened at Vatican II. In the same way, however, those who seek to control the narrative about him are shaping the outcomes of popular opinion in a church that largely has not bothered to read any of what he has actually written. Everybody has opinions about Vatican II, but nobody's read it. Everybody has opinions about Pope Francis, but nobody has read his writings either. It's always quicker to read somebody's review of a document than to read the actual document. If you have a book at home called Catholic for Dummies, throw it away. Go straight to the documents of the church. Unfortunately, we would be left only with someone's opinion of his writings, and we are uncertain of their motives. Opinions are formed without any basis in fact or knowledge about the Pope's real intentions. And still he is demanding reform in all areas of the church. Reform is not easy. We always prefer to be content with what is familiar. Reform is demanding because it means we must change. It's easier to allow others to quote Pope Francis out of context and stain his reputation than be confronted with what he is demanding. And it was the same with the scribes and the Pharisees in the gospel today. Jesus is demanding change of hearts to reform his creation. In the gospel today, Jesus' life is in danger because he was calling out the hypocrisy, the corruption, the manipulation, and the clericalism of their church leaders. He was threatening their status quo, and they were very angry, angry enough to kill him. There are many things going on in today's gospel that are unlawful. Of course, there was a woman who was caught in adultery, and Jesus acknowledges the sin. And in a certain sense, she is guilty as charged. But Jesus points out that no one is without sin. For one thing, they brought a woman caught in adultery into the temple, which was against the law. They somehow, I think, set this up so that they could drag her into Jesus at this particular moment. So I don't think that they weren't complicit in this sin either. But they're willing to destroy her to get to him. And, by the way, they're seeking to kill Jesus. His response is very interesting. It is completely not according to the law books. She should be stoned according to the law of Moses, they say. But what she did, even though it was not right, is not as bad as what they are doing. What they're doing is worse. Jesus' response is completely different than any foreseen response. He is quiet. They had no idea how to react to him. They walked away. This is the kind of thing I imagine Pope Francis doing. But the point of the scene was this: no one present had the role of being her judge, not even Jesus. So as I said, reform, not change for its own sake. Reform means things need to change. They need to be corrected. So I want to go back a moment to Vatican II. The reform of Vatican II actually was a turning back to the first centuries, but especially the time before so many changes were made in the crisis caused by the Protestant Reformation in 1517, because changes were made in reaction to Protestantism. They weren't choices freely chosen. Martin Luther wanted the Catholic Church to restore the importance of the Word of God at Mass. Its importance had become minimized, preaching was optional, and did not have to be about the Scriptures at all, which were proclaimed only in Latin. Most people couldn't understand the readings. And on top of that, most people actually attended low mass when the scriptures themselves were read silently only by the priest. They weren't even proclaimed out loud. Luther also wanted the church to acknowledge that human beings could not earn salvation by their own acts. Good works could not buy heaven, but that salvation came only by God's freely given grace. These were the original teachings of St. Augustine himself. Luther was a faithful Augustinian priest. He wanted to restore communion under both forms at the Mass. He wanted the Mass to be celebrated in the vernacular language. The Council of Trent established the Mass, which was in use up until Vatican II, in which these things simply didn't happen because they wanted people to be clear what was Catholic and what was not. If you went into a church and it wasn't in Latin, you had to get out of there because it wasn't Catholic. The church was actually actively discussing all of these reforms before Martin Luther's protest that started the schism. Even in 1960, the overwhelming majority of Catholics had never read the Bible or even owned one. So do you think this needed to change? For most Catholics, personal reading of the Bible was something only Protestants did. But among Catholic theologians and pastors, there had developed a renewed interest in the Bible in the 20th century. Pope Pius XII's encyclical in 1943, Divino Afflante Spiritu, gave a renewed impetus to Catholic biblical studies and encouraged the production of new Bible translations from the original languages, not medieval English. This led to a pastoral attempt to get ordinary Catholics to rediscover the scriptures, to read them, and to make them a source of their spiritual life. This found a response in very limited circles in the 40s and 50s. By 1960, it was still in its infancy. And I would propose to you that we still have a lot of work to do on this today. So let us listen again to the beauty of the words of God placed in the heart of Isaiah in the first reading. He says, "Remember not the events of the past, the things of long ago consider not. See, I am doing something new. See how it springs up. Do you not see it? A way through the desert, rivers through the wasteland, so you might drink, so you might not die of thirst." God did not create our wasteland, but he is reforming it. Reform requires us to change, and change is difficult, especially when we are even slightly comfortable with the way things are. So let us look around, immediately around ourselves. Are we where we need to be spiritually? How is it with your soul? That was a favorite question of Charles Wesley, the founder of the Methodists. How is it with your soul? Does anything in your life need to change? Look around our families, our church, our society, our neighborhoods. Can anyone look around and say, "It's all fine. We're good. No further change is needed"? What about our country, our world, with never before seen records of people fleeing from danger and violence and war on multiple continents? Poverty, suffering, famine, disease, war. How much condemnation do we all deserve for this world we find ourselves in? It is no doubt change has to come, but no one person or faction has any solution to solving this. We must turn to none other than Christ himself, who in his pure mercy desires nothing but the reform that is necessary for us and for our salvation. As in the gospel today, it's mercy, not condemnation. And we hope to hear Jesus say to us, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, do not sin anymore."